Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
We're going to pick up and finish out chapter 5 and chapter, at least the first part of chapter 6 tonight. So very quickly, just by way of review, where we are in the text structurally, remember that we are really under the heading of walking in wisdom, starting in chapter 5, verse 15. And you may recall that there are a number of different things that Paul tells us that we ought to do in order to explain walking in wisdom. Like, for example, he tells us that we need to redeem the time, which is the idea of taking advantage of the opportunities when they're presented to us. He'll tell us that we need to not be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. That's verse 18. And then remember, he defines that for us. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, and giving thanks for all things to God the Father in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and then submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now remember that verse 22 and following, really through chapter 6, verse 9, is an elaboration on what Paul means, or maybe I should say it this way, not an elaboration so much, but maybe some specific examples of what Paul means when he talks about submitting to one another in the fear of God. And you write down Mark chapter 10, I believe it's about verse 35 through 42. We used that as an illustration last week to talk about what kind of submission Paul has in mind in a general way. You remember that this is the context where the disciples are arguing about, or the apostles are arguing about, who's going to occupy a position of authority in the kingdom of God. And what Jesus says to them is that, you know, the Gentiles, they are the ones who exercise authority and lord that over one another. Like jockeying for seats in the presidential cabinet is essentially what's happening here. And so Jesus says, look, really, if you want to be great, that greatness is going to come through what? Through humble service, right? So serving one another. So we talked about our relationships in general and how relationships, as the Bible describes them, they're reciprocal, and each member in any kind of relationship has a role to play in that relationship with the other, right? So we could talk about, for example, the relationship between the elders and the church members. The elders have a role to play, right? They're in a position of authority, and they are to lead, and they are to exemplify Christianity, and so on. And then the flock has the responsibility of honoring and respecting that leadership and following their example and following their lead, right? So they both work together. But also we talked about the fact that when one party in a relationship fulfills their role, then it makes it easier for the other to fulfill theirs. But the opposite is also true. If one is not working to fulfill their role, then it makes it more difficult for the other to fulfill theirs. All right, well, all that applies, really, I think you could say, in just about every relationship there is. But now Paul's talking about the relationship between husbands and wives and parents and children and servants and masters coming up in chapter 6. So we talked about husbands and wives quite a bit last week. And what Paul does is he says, all right, first of all, wives, you have the responsibility of submitting to your husbands, and you must submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. So there's a parallel, there's a parallel between the way that the church submits to Christ and the way that the wife submits to the husband. And this is really all about recognizing headship and leadership and authority. So the wife has the responsibility of recognizing the fact that God has put her husband as the head of her and of the home and the family, and not doing anything to undermine him or disrespect his headship in any way, but rather, like at the end of verse 24, so let the wives be subject to their own husbands and everything. It's really the idea of a disposition. It's a personality. It's a frame of mind. A wife who recognizes that position and always does what she can to support and to follow the lead. Now, you will notice, interestingly enough, and I'll mention this again in chapter 6, you'll notice that Paul uses the word subject or submit. He doesn't use the word obey in all things. And I think that's significant. Because later when he talks to children, he will use the word obey. And again, this is something that we've talked about before. I think we talked about it last week. God does not expect a wife in her submission to her husband to obey him in everything that he says. For example, if he requests that she does something that is contrary to the will of God. The Acts 5:29 principle always applies, right? Okay, well, the husband, on the other hand, he has responsibilities as well. And his responsibility toward his wife is not to rule over her as some kind of a tyrant or a dictator or something like that. He is to love her as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. So sacrificial love, a willingness for a husband to sacrifice and give whatever is needed to his wife. And in so doing, he's looking to provide for her in a number of different ways. All right, so we pick up in verse 26, for example. And as Paul talks about the reason why Jesus gave himself for the church, here's what he says, that he might sanctify her and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having any spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. All right, if you were to try and describe in verse 26 and verse 27, just in a simple way, what is the ideal here that's being described for the church? What does Jesus want for the church? What would you say? Somebody said something, but I didn't hear it. Yeah, purity or holiness. That would be the word that would come to my mind, but those are synonymous, right? What Jesus wants for the church is for the church to be holy, for the church to be pure. Now, if you're connecting dots, you need to connect that back to chapter 1, verses 4 through 6, but we won't rehash that now. All right, so if Jesus wants for the church to be pure and to be holy, how would you then take that and apply that to a husband and a wife? I'm probably not asking this in a very clear way, but let's just see. What do you think? How would you apply that? How does that principle carry over? Let me ask it this way. What trait or characteristic do these two passages tell us that a husband should prioritize for his wife? Okay, sacrificial love, that's certainly the attitude that he'll display. But what I'm getting at here is, how about providing for spiritual needs? Right? If Jesus died in sacrificial love to the church because he wants her to be holy, well, it seems to me that if I'm going to relate that to a husband and wife, that a husband ought to desire his wife's holiness as well. That he ought to desire that she is the person that God would have her to be. And so what does that mean? That he's going to do everything he can to do what? To provide for her in that way, right? To make sure that he gives her what she needs to grow spiritually. He provides for her spiritual needs. How about verse 28? He says, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Interesting little note, when he uses the word ought, the word ought implies an obligation, all right? It's a moral obligation, if you will. So husbands have this moral obligations to love their own wives as they love their own body, because he who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. All right, what kind of needs are we talking about in verse 28 and 29? What is he saying about a husband and his own body and his view toward his own body? What does he say?
It's self-preservation is natural.
Yeah.
Right? So the desire to preserve or protect or provide for the wife should be just as natural.
Yep, I like that. Self-preservation is natural, so the desire to provide and protect should also be natural. Yeah, I think that's right. Let me ask you this. Does Paul say that a man makes a habit of abusing his own body? No. What does he do? He nourishes it and cherishes it. Well, what does that mean? He nourishes it and cherishes it. He takes care of himself, right? Or he should. Yeah, he should take care of himself, right? We're talking about an obligation. Should happen. All right, so same question as before. How then do we relate that to the responsibility that a man has for his wife? Well, I think you could say that he needs to make sure and provide for her physical and emotional needs as well. Just as he's going to take care of his own, and he needs to provide for hers. Yeah, go ahead, Lewis. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Lewis said he shouldn't treat himself better than he treats his wife, and I think that's right. That's a good way of putting it. All right, so husbands, you have the same kind of love that Jesus has for the church, for your wife, which means you be willing to sacrifice yourself. You put her first and her needs first. Specifically, you make sure that spiritual needs are provided for. But you also make sure that physical needs are provided for and emotional needs. Make sure that those are provided for as well. The Lord provides those. You provide them. And then look at verse 31. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. I should have read that with verse... I'm sorry. Let me just back up. I'm all confused here. Verse 30. For we are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason shall a man leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. All right, here's the idea. In verse 30 and 31, a husband loves his wife because she has become part of him. Right? A husband loves his wife in a sacrificial way and provides the things for her that she needs because she has become part of him. The two have become one. And this is a great mystery, he says, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. What's the mystery? Probably, I would say the mystery is in reference to the idea of two becoming one. But there's the point is that there's a parallel between the relationship between Christ and the church and the husband and wife. So nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Okay. So submitting to one another in the fear of God, the first illustration that Paul would like for us to consider along that line is the relationship between husband and wife. How the wife submits to her husband and respects his headship, but how he loves her sacrificially and provides for her all of the different needs and things that she has. And when those two things are working together in tandem, it's something that's beautiful and it's something that glorifies God. All right? Now, look at chapter 6. We'll call chapter 6 Fighting for Christ because of the armor of God in verses 10 through 20. But let's talk a little bit about the first 9 verses. Again, they go with what was before. So let's talk about them, and then as time allows, we'll work through the armor of God. Let's read together verses 1 through 4. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the teaching or the nurturing and the admonition of the Lord. All right, so again, we have a reciprocal relationship here. Children have a role, and fathers or parents have a role. So let's look at it. What's the role of children? Well, children are to obey their parents in the Lord. Notice again the usage of obey here as opposed to submit, as it was in the last section. Obey your parents in the Lord. What does he mean, obey your parents in the Lord? What does that phrase mean? Obey your parents in the Lord. Grammatically, it might interest you to note that the phrase in the Lord modifies the word obey. So it's something like this, obey in the Lord, or maybe obey based upon, obey your parents based upon the relationship that you have with the Lord or the authority that the Lord has over you. You obey your parents because you recognize that that's what the Lord expects and you serve the Lord. Maybe something like that. Obey your parents in the Lord. Let me ask you this. What does that command imply about parents? Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. And if that's God's will, then you're empowered by Him through His Spirit to do that, right?
Yeah, God has given. Yes, God has set this relationship in place. Jeff. Sure, yeah, parents should never expect a child to do something outside of the Lord's will, and God would never expect a child to do something outside of the Lord's will. I think we might be overthinking this a little bit, though. Here's what I'm getting at. If children are told that you have to obey your parents and the Lord, then that implies that the parents have to give something to obey. That implies that parents have to set boundaries, and then they have to expect obedience to those boundaries, right? And that shouldn't surprise us because that's what our God does, isn't it? The relationship between parents and children is a great parallel between the relationship that we have with our God. All right, well, children, obey your parents in the Lord because this is right. Or, if you will, well, let me ask you this. Why is it right? Why does he say because this is right? Well, maybe that's just his way of saying because that's what the Lord expects you to do. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. If you didn't hear Lewis, basically what he said is that parenting is not an accident. That it is something that is done, what word did you use? Deliberately, yes. That it's something that's done deliberately. Yes, ma'am. Yep, that's right. Did you have your hand up? She just quoted Psalm, or read Psalm 19:8. All right, so children, you have a responsibility to obey. You obey your parents in the Lord. You obey your parents based on the relationship and the authority that you have in the Lord. This is right. Well, it's because it's what the Lord expects you to do. But he's not done. He also says, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment, and with promise that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. So what does it mean to honor your father and mother? Somebody said, yeah, so it certainly has to do with respect. Yes, that's right. But it also goes a little bit further than that. Do you remember, the chapter and verse reference escapes me. Maybe somebody can find it or can just quote it for us. But do you remember, on one occasion, Jesus condemned the Pharisees because of Corban? Do you remember this? What was going on there? You see, God expected adult children to be able to care for the physical needs of their parents in older age. And how were they skirting around that responsibility? That's right. They took the money and they said, "Now this is Corban. This is dedicated to God," right? And so they were shirking their responsibility. Well, that is the opposite of honoring your parents. Certainly it involves the respect aspect, but it also involves the care and the provision, taking care of them aspect. Do you remember in 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul talks about this a bit in 1 Timothy chapter 5. I think I've got the chapter right on that. It might be chapter 4. But he talks about the fact that this is the passage where if a man doesn't provide for his own, that he's worse than an infidel and he's denied the faith. Well, the context of all of that, a big large part of it has to do with providing for parents. And particularly for widows. Remember he talks about widows who are, this King James Version, widows who are widows indeed. Which is a way of saying they have no one, no children, no one's there to provide for them. All right, I digress. But anyway, so honoring your mother and father. Notice, by the way, that it seems to me at least that Paul covers the whole gambit here. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Maybe that has to do with children who are younger and still at home in general. Honor your father and mother. That has to do with all children, but particularly when we grow up and when we leave home and when we become adults and our parents are older. Either way, he says this is the first commandment with promise. So what does he mean by that? Well, go read Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12. It's not the first commandment, but it's the first commandment where there's some kind of a promise or some kind of a result that's attached to it. And so what he says is, it'll be well with you and you'll live long on the earth. You might say that that's a bit of a proverbial statement. He isn't saying that, you know what, if you honor your parents the way that you should, that life is always going to be great, because some people are great children, they honor their parents, and they just have a really hard life. But it's a general truth, it's a general principle, and the idea here is that you're going to generally have a decent, pretty good life if you do it that way. And I guess if you want to be a little bit comical about it, although it's not all that comical, if you're growing up and, you know, you're being reared and raised by your parents, which life is going to be better for you? Which existence? The one where you honor and respect your parents and you stay out of trouble? Or the one where you're constantly violating the rules and you find yourself in the Valley of Achor over and over again? I don't really do it anymore, but we've got one of those, you know, those little benches that you put at the foot of your bed and open up the lid and you put blankets in there and all that. When the kids were younger, when I say the kids, I mean Jonah and Elijah, when they were younger, back in Texas, I called that seat the Valley of Achor, because that's where we went to correct our behavior. Anyway, Valley of Achor for a door of hope. All right, well, here we go. So fathers have a responsibility as well, and he says that fathers are not to provoke their children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Okay, what does it mean to provoke children to wrath? What do you suppose that means? This is a great illustration, by the way, when you're studying and reading your Bible, if you will consult maybe two or three different translations, it helps. Because one translation uses the word exasperate. Do not exasperate your children. And I think another one uses the translation or the idea of frustrate. Do not frustrate your children. And as far as I can tell, I think that captures the idea. The point here is, do not frustrate and discourage your children by being overbearing and unfair in your treatment to them. I think that's the idea of it. You might note how there's some interesting parallels to what Paul said to the husbands and how they're to relate to their wives as well. Husbands and husbands are given this position of headship and authority in the family, that includes the relationship with the wife, but it also includes the relationship with the children. And, you know, God says, look, you can't lord this and be a ruthless dictator over your wife. Well, you shouldn't do that with your kids either. So don't provoke them to evil. Do not frustrate and discourage them, tear them down or whatever by being overbearing and unfair and calloused and so on. But instead, bring them up in the nurturing or the training and the admonition of the Lord. So what's the difference between training and admonition? You might say that one is positive and the other is negative. And what I mean by that is with training, think about that in terms of teaching. These are we're teaching children. This is how you should, this is what you should do. So then what's admonition? If it's the negative, if it's the negative partner to training or teaching, what would it be? What not to do. Or, if you will, the application or the correction, right? Here's what you should do, and when you don't do what you should do, here's how we deal with it. Training and you have your hand up, go ahead. You're good.
To me, this is why it's so important that the husband and wife be on the same page when it comes to raising the children.
Yeah.
Because the mother and her
sure.
have that innate ability to be able to train the children correctly, whereas dad's going to be more disciplinary.
Yep.
You know, after a long day at work, I would get home. The first thing I would ask is, what do you want to come in?
Sure.
And then next, you know,
that's right.
Because if it's me doing it alone, there's a higher likelihood
yep.
it's not going to be as well done. And there's a more possibility of a frustration
yep.
that they provoke to act, especially when they open it. The bottom line is they're still children.
Yep.
And that can sometimes be difficult for dads to remember it.
That's right. That's exactly right. If you didn't hear Lewis, basically what he's saying is, you know, this is a good reminder of the wisdom of God in creating a home with a man and a woman, a mother and a father, because we're wired differently, and we both, the husband and the wife, the mom and the dad, we both bring something different to the table and the relationship and the raising of children. But we have to be on the same page because we work together. All right, very good. So children, obey your parents and honor them. Fathers, do not provoke them, don't exasperate them, don't discourage them and frustrate them, but instead, nurture them. That's the idea. Bring them up in the training and in the admonition of the Lord. Now, how about servants and masters? Later on, I can't tell you when exactly, but later on, before this quarter's over, the plan is that we're going to study Philemon for just a little bit. We're going to do the one-chapter books. I think I told you guys about that. We're going to do the one-chapter books to finish out the quarter, and so part of that is Philemon, and we'll talk more about this when we get there. But slaves and masters, servants and masters, that is an interesting topic in the New Testament, and for obvious reasons, I suppose. So let me just say a couple of things briefly about this before we work through the text. When you read about servants or slaves in your New Testaments, you shouldn't think about it in terms of what we usually think about when we use the word slavery, because it wasn't really anything like that kind of slavery. And there are a number of reasons why. So let me give you just a few. Number one, it had absolutely nothing to do with race or ethnicity or skin color or language or any of that. None whatsoever. You could walk down the street in an ancient Roman city and you would not be able to tell in many ways who was a servant and who wasn't. In fact, it's not coming to me right off hand, but There's an ancient writer who records the fact that somebody had the idea in Rome at one point that all of the slaves needed to wear some kind of identifying mark, like a blue sash or something. And then somebody else came back and said, you know, I don't think that's a good idea, because if we do that, then everyone will see just how numerous the servants are in the empire, and then we might have a problem, right? Now, I'm just pointing that out to say that, again, you walk down the street in an ancient Roman city, you can't tell, you don't know. Some servants were involved in professions that we today view as very important professions. Like, for example, doctors and nurses. That was a slave's profession in the ancient Roman world. Artists, musicians, sculptors, things of that nature. Often you would have a situation where you may have a very wealthy Roman citizen, and he will have a servant in his household, and he will appoint that servant to be the manager or the administrator, or maybe you'd like the word foreman. And so his job then would be to manage his affairs. Maybe he has vineyards. Well, he's in charge of the vineyards and all of the workers and laborers in that vineyard. Maybe he's the one who's going to be responsible for managing the finances of whatever his agricultural operation happens to be. But the point here is that this is someone who's given a great deal of responsibility. It might even interest you to note that in the Roman Empire, there were some slaves who, when given the opportunity to be free, chose to stay enslaved because their life as a servant in a wealthy patron's household was far better in terms of quality than it would have ever been had they been free. Because there wasn't really in the Roman world, you know, we have this idea, or this idea in the United States where, you know, we can be born into poverty and we can work very hard and we can climb the ladder. Well, that didn't exist in the Roman world. You sort of just were what you were. You couldn't do anything about it. Some wealthy slaves in the Roman Empire even owned their own slaves. And I use the word wealthy because some of them would have actually been paid wages for the work that they did. All right, so there's a whole lot more that could be said about it, but suffice that for now. We'll talk about it more when we look at Philemon. So suffice it for now to just point out that this was a very, very different world. All right? Now, all of that said, that doesn't mean that everybody just had a stellar life and a stellar existence. In fact, Rome actually had laws on the books governing how folks treated their servants, but that didn't mean that everybody obeyed the law. All right? So here's what the gospel has done. What the gospel has done is it has transformed this relationship between servant and master to the point where it essentially legislated the practice out of existence. Sometimes someone asks, why doesn't the New Testament condemn slavery? Because you notice it doesn't. And the answer to that question is what I just said. It doesn't condemn it, but what it does is it changes the relationship dynamics so that it effectively legislates it out of existence. More on that when we talk about Philemon. All right, so just like husbands and wives and parents and children, servants and masters, they have a responsibility to each other. So here we go. Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart as to Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart with good will. Doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. All right, servants, you have a responsibility to be obedient to your masters according to the flesh. Well, how should you do that? Well, you should do it with fear and trembling and sincerity. What does that mean? Well, you should do it with the right attitude, reverence, respect. And notice that he uses the word sincerity. And then he elaborates on it in verse number 6, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. In other words, as you carry out your various responsibilities, do it with purpose, not just as someone who's sort of going through the actions to do the minimum that you can to get by, but doing it with purpose, doing the best job that you can do, as if you are serving the Lord. Notice the comparison. With goodwill, doing service to the Lord and not to men, and all the while knowing, verse 8, that the Lord is going to take care of you. Whatever good anyone does, he'll receive the same from the Lord, whether he's slave or free. You should go read Colossians chapter 3, incidentally, as Paul gives, he talks about this there too, and it's a great commentary. But the idea here is that servants have the responsibility of submitting and having the right attitude and carrying out their responsibilities to the best of their ability as if they're serving Christ, knowing that the Lord sees all and he knows all and he will reward and punish accordingly. All right, well, you masters do the same things to them, verse 9, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master is also in heaven and there's no partiality with him. Notice, do the same things to them. Here is where we get to the legislating it out of existence part, the changing of the relationship. What does he mean when he says, do the same things to them? What are the same things? How about things like sincerity and fear and trembling and goodwill and service? You see, this captures sort of an attitude, of a mindset. And so the point here is, yes, you may be the master and they may be the servant. However, you still have to treat them with a certain amount of dignity and respect and humanity. And the reason why is because just like they're going to answer for how they carry out their service, you're going to answer for what? Verse number 9. You're going to answer for how you carry out your role over them as well, right? There is no partiality with God. So, that's the change in the relationship. Both treat one another with respect and dignity and humanity and service. Okay. Well, that brings us to the armor of God then. We're almost done. Next week will be our last class in Ephesians, Lord willing, incidentally. So here we go. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, because we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand the evil day, and having done all, to stand. All right, let's look at this with what time we have left. Paul says, first, I want you to be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Look at that phrase, be strong in the Lord. Note that when he says, be strong in the Lord, that statement is in the passive voice. And the significance of that is, you are not the one securing the strength. Another way of saying it would be like this: allow yourself to be strengthened. All right? So allow yourself to be strengthened. Well, strengthened where? In the Lord and in the power of his might. So we're allowing the Lord to strengthen us is the idea here. It's the strength that God provides by the power of his might. So the idea of it is something like this. The Lord is mighty, and he has the ability to provide us strength and might as he is strong and mighty. So allow him to do it. Allow the Lord to give you this strength. All right, well, how is the Lord going to do that? Well, that's verse number 11. Put on the whole armor of God. The way that the Lord provides this strength is through this armor that he has crafted and provided for us. Well, he says, put on the whole armor of God. That's the idea of being fully equipped as a soldier. And the reason why that's important is so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. That word able, or the idea of it, it's a word picture, it's a military term, and the idea is being able to hold a position. So allow the Lord to strengthen you so that you may be able to stand firm and hold your position. Well, hold your position against what? Well, against the wiles of the devil. Look at the word wiles. That's the Greek term gives us our English word methods. Method or methods. So what is a method or a method? Methods. It's just a different way, right? It's a different tool or a different strategy. So the reason why we have to be strong and able to stand and hold our position or hold our ground is because of not just the wile or the method singular, but the wiles or the methods plural of the devil. I like to think of it in terms of a toolbox, right? The devil has a toolbox and it's full of tools. He has a lot of different ways that he can come at you. All right, we are not wrestling against flesh and blood. The word wrestle is a word that has to do with hand-to-hand combat. And he says, we're not engaged in hand-to-hand combat against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So the idea is that our combat, this combat that we're engaged in, is not combat of a physical nature, it's combat of a spiritual nature. And these terms that he uses, principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this age and spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places, I think it's hard to know for sure exactly what he has in mind with each individual one. But the idea, of course, is that there are these forces of evil that are alive and at work, and we're battling against them. All right? So, because we are to stand our ground, stand our position against the methods and tools and wiles of the devil and all of his forces that he employs, because we have that obligation, verse 13, therefore, take up the whole armor of God so that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. Notice there's an implication here. If you don't take up the whole armor of God, you won't be able to withstand in the evil day, right? Connect withstanding to being strong or allowing yourself to be strengthened. Paul says, I want you to be strong in the Lord. I want you to be able to withstand. And the Lord has given you the ability to do it. Notice at the end of the passage, he says, and having done all to stand. That phrase, having done all, is the idea of preparation. So it's not just a call to allow ourselves to be strengthened with the might or the power or the strength that the Lord gives, but there is a preparation that goes into it. There's a process, if you will. Well, what's the process? What's the preparation? Well, it's putting on the armor and every piece. So then we need to understand better about what the armor is. And that's verses 14 through 20. I think we'll stop there, though. It's a good stopping point. So, Lord willing, we will pick up here in verse 14. We'll finish up the book next week, and then we'll be on to the one-chapter books of the Bible. And the plan is that we'll begin in Jude, and Mr. Tom is going to take care of that. So appreciate your attention and participation, and we'll see you next week.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.